I got interested in bread baking when I was at Pacific Lutheran University in Tacoma. We had Eucharist every single Sunday, communion every single Sunday, and we always baked bread for it. Well, then that gave us a lot of time to fiddle around with the recipe and come up with one that worked well. Have any of you used bread in your at your churches or mm-hmm. tried to bake it? Mm-hmm. Come on in. Excuse me? Is there an empty place?
Yeah.
The snack bar? The library reading room? Oh. We'll be done in about 40 minutes. You made unleavened bread. And how did that work?
Cool.
Not very much at all. Did you go ahead and use it in the service? Or?
Yes, we did.
Mm-hmm. And the reaction was?
Oh, it was fine.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, that's right. That's right. But it sounds like it was pretty tough. And you, so you had to chew it a while. Yeah. Do you use a common cup or the individual glasses?
Usually the individual.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And have you used bread at all?
No, we haven't.
And have you?
Yes, for years.
Mm-hmm.
And the common cup.
And the common cup.
The bread's
mm-hmm. Have you had any problems with the bread or?
No, not really.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes, I mean, very rarely a loaf has come out that was pretty tough. But that's,
yeah.
Everybody.
That happens. Yeah. Well, the things that I've discovered, the most problems that people have with bread are crumbiness, crumbs a lot, that it's sometimes very difficult to tear. For example, if someone has forgotten to bake it, someone will pick up a loaf of French bread from the grocery on the way to church. And the pastor gets up there, and when it comes time to break the bread, it's like ripping a telephone book, literally. It's just impossible. And then there's cornmeal all over, and it's horrid. And besides that, it doesn't look very good. It doesn't. When it's a French bread loaf, it won't fit a basket, and it's hard to carry up. So what we came up with was a recipe that basically, it's just very simple. It's twice as much yeast, so it's a very light bread. Use eggs and butter for structure so that it's richer. Sometimes if you make it very rich, it comes out almost like a pound cake, almost that kind of closeness of a texture. Added the spice cardamom, just a little bit of that, just a hint, because we're looking for a good taste in one bite. This is not sandwich bread. This is one bite of communion bread. And also then played around with some glazes so that the bread would look nice and it would tear easily. The glazes that we use are, before it is baked, wash it with egg yolk and milk, a 1-to-1, so it's probably about a tablespoon of milk, whisked together. Brush that on just before it goes in the oven, and it makes it nice and shiny. Then on the way, just after it comes out, you use the egg white and milk. That takes longer to whisk together because of the texture of the egg yolk. That just doesn't mix as well. But that makes it nice and soft. So you have a rich, soft bread, and when the pastor goes to break the bread, it just falls apart, and it tears very easily, and the crust is not embarrassing to eat. That can be, I don't know if you've ever seen the pastor coming and you know you're going to get a piece of crust, and you wonder, what am I going to do? Some people are very put off by that. You can imagine that switching to something like a loaf could be very disconcerting. I wrote down the recipe here. I don't know how much you all bake. Okay. Oh, okay. It's really quite fun. It really is. It's one of those things that the more you do it, the more fun it is, I think. I just love to do it. I can copy this recipe down. We did not have a blackboard, chalkboard in here today, and I would have liked to have one so that you could see it. Basically, what I do in the recipe is take one package of yeast and proof it. This is the old-fashioned way to make sure it was still working. And what it does is start the yeast growing. One package of yeast in a half a cup of warm water, about the temperature you wash your hands in. You can stand it, the yeast can stand it. And if you can't, the same reasoning follows. The yeast cannot stand it and will die, and the bread won't rise. And then put in some sugar. And that starts it foaming right away, and you're actually producing more yeast for the price of only one package. It also gets the yeast acting and moving, so your bread will rise faster. It's very simple, really, a very simple chemistry here. The warmer you keep your kitchen and your yeast and your ingredients, the quicker the bread will rise, and the colder, the slower. Many times I'll make the bread up the night before, say, and form it into loaves and let it rise in the refrigerator. Then I can get up and put it right in. I don't have to wait all day on a batch of bread. Any large cookbook will have step-by-step pictures of how to bake bread. You can, it's one of those things that's nice to learn from someone, because there's a certain feel about it that the pictures won't let you know. But they're, if you do it once or twice and then you're doing it on your own and you get stuck, Joy of Cooking or Betty Crocker or Better Homes and Gardens or Sunset especially is very good, has just step by step right down the way. Then I like to use 2 eggs, a cup of liquid, and I hope that it's usually milk. I use dried milk a lot because I live alone and I don't go through that much milk, and it tastes just the same. They have dried buttermilk and dried regular milk, and you can use water, but I'd prefer to use milk. Then another 2 tablespoons of sugar, preferably brown sugar. It gives it a little bit more of a caramely taste. A tablespoon of salt, which is usually more salt than most recipes call for. That, again, is so that it tastes good in one bite. If you have somebody in your family who doesn't need that much salt, then cut it some. There's a lot of special diets floating around now, so. And then the special, extra special asterisk ingredient is cardamom. If you have any Norwegian or Danish grandmas around, they'll say, "Did you grind your own?" You can get them in little pods at the grocery store, and inside the pod are some hard little nut things, and you smash them between 2 spoons, like you do for little kids for aspirin when you hide it in the jelly, so they'll take it. Oh, I've never used.
Put in a plastic bag and
use it. Uh huh. And I only use just a little bit. I only use 2 or 3 pods, just to give it a little bit of a hint of cardamom. Most cardamom recipes at Christmas time that call for cardamom call for quite a bit, I think. It's the second most expensive spice. You're using something really nice here. Saffron is the only one that's more expensive. That's used for soups and colorings. And I smash it between 2 spoons. You have to get the hang of it because it'll shoot around the kitchen. And try to get it ground fairly small, because if someone lands on that in their mouth, they're going to know it. It's a very pungent spice. Then you combine the yeast mixture and the second mixture and stir in flour until it comes away from the side of the bowl. And then probably 2 cups more. Works out between 4 and 8 cups. I'm to the point with bread baking that I kind of do it by feel, how much it comes in. You want to keep the dough as light as possible. It's like a cinnamon roll dough. You don't want to put in too much flour, or that'll make it heavy. So you try to keep it, you knead it until it is like elastic. What you're doing with bread is, especially in white flour, is using the glutens to catch the alcohol and carbon dioxide the yeast give off. And they poof up. The gluten structure is like elastic that catches that. Well, the trick is, it's like elastic in your old pajama bottoms, you know? That only lasted so long. Well, these glutens will only stretch so far. If they go more than twice, they won't come back up again. That's why they always say rise until just double, or rise until almost double, and you punch it down again. And that gluten is that gluten structure is only present in white bread. So that's why communion bread that has whole wheat, that's, you know, 100% whole wheat, just crumbles all over the place, and it gets in the carpeting, and you don't know what to do. It's because the whole wheat structure, whole wheat flour doesn't have that structure. It just sits there, and it's kind of heavy. So always in your communion bread, have at least 80% white flour, or get it, or start there and play around with it until you're at a comfortable place. Some pastors and congregations are more tolerant of crumbs than others. Does it crumb a lot? Well, then whoever is baking it knows what he or she is doing. In a basket, it would not be that obvious. If you were standing, if you were kneeling at an altar rail on a red carpet or a linoleum floor, and the morning sun is streaming in, and you're at the third table, there'll be a little trail of crumbs around. And for people who are used to receiving a wafer and having everything being neat and tidy, that can be very upsetting. Or it's just, you know, it's one of those things that when there's a change, people will latch on to or wish it weren't so. I've done this, I've talked to people about this in groups of 20 or 30 or 40, and one time I said very quietly, "What's your biggest problem with bread?" And this resounding shout came out of the last two rows. They said, "Crumbs!" So I said, "Okay, I guess we'll talk about that today." So it's a very basic recipe, and I can certainly copy it for you if you'd like. The main idea is a rich recipe with a little bit of cardamom in it. You can also complement this bread with wines. Christian Brothers, you're a California person, Christian Brothers, the shipping costs other places from Christian Brothers can be exorbitant. But the basic cost of their wine is incredibly low. California person. And, okay, the thing is, the sacramental wine part of Christian Brothers, for example, one bottle of Chateau LaSalle was $3 or over, and 3 cents a fifth. Mm-hmm. And that's a big difference. The thing is that we know where their money goes. It goes into education, and we know that all their pickers are AFL-CIO. So it's an ethical use of our money, and it's good wine. I realized this year that, though, in the Roman Catholic Church, only the priests drink the wine. So they have been making wine just for the priests now for about 150 years. Since Vatican II, they've changed that so that the laity may receive. I'm not sure how widespread the practice is, but they will send you brochures and shipping blanks. They will even set up a wine tasting. I've done two or three in the Bay Area, and they supply the wine to me for free. I have to go and pick it up. But that can be a lot of fun for an adult Sunday school class, for example. Change it to Sunday night and you have a sacramental wine tasting. That's a good way to talk about worship. That's a good way to talk about the Eucharist or to just throw open some ideas. And it can be just a lot of fun. A lot of their wines are rather sweet, awfully, almost too sweet. But of course, in one taste, you're not that aware of it. They have, their sacramental wine is sacramental wine because of a certain process it's made by. Kosher is to Jewish, as sacramental wine is to Christian Brothers. It's a set of laws, canon law, put together by the Roman Catholic Church as to how much sugar content and what process things are added. And they'll tell you all about it, and the fellow who does it in California, and I'm sure there's a representative in Minnesota, loves to talk about it. And the only way they will advertise their sacramental wines is through a wine tasting. So if you show a little interest, they'll respond graciously, I can assure you. Now, the other part about bread baking is that's the practical aspect. One other thing I should say is to bake bread, you're giving it a gift, an aesthetic gift. So play around with the formation of the loaves. I like to bake mine on a cookie sheet so that it's a flat loaf and tie it in a knot or braid it. There's one knot where you take the dough and make it into a long snake and then tie it in a half knot. And it stands up nice and high that way and is really a beautiful loaf. The Tassajara bread book, which we have over here in the bookstore, has a lot of ideas on how to twist the bread and how to make the bread in a free-form way. When people walk into church and see the bread there on a table at the base of the aisle with the wine, they know it's going to be communion, and when it's a nice loaf to look at, I think that adds to it. I think a loaf pan's fine, but at the same time, I think it lets the baker be a little creative. I shy away from using sesame seeds or poppy seeds or anything like that on a loaf. Theologically, it's a little shaky, and it also is messier. Yeah, and also people, you get a raspberry seed cut in there. You can imagine what a sesame seed or poppy seed. And there's a few folks who do. Yeah, the same thing with raisins and nuts. I don't put them in. Most people don't, but sometimes there's a question. So that's the practical, 10 or 15 minutes of this presentation. The other bent is to why do we do it? What is the biblical base, or what are the biblical images, or what has come out of the community of faith now that we would even consider using a loaf of leavened bread? Many times people are very happy to change over, but they want to have a reasonable part in the decision making, and I think that speaks well for them. You know that everything we do in church has a symbolic edge to it. Everything in church we speak about is a symbol, and so there's a lot of layers to it. Bread is exactly the same way. We can talk about bread till we're blue in the face as a symbol. The nice thing, I think, about the Hebrews and the tradition they've given to us is that their concept of heaven was a banquet where you could eat and eat and eat and never get satiated. Know how after Christmas meal or Thanksgiving meal or a big reception or something, you don't want to move because you're so full? I haven't done that for a long time now, but there is a time. And so their idea of heaven was all the good parts of a banquet and leave out the bad part. You never get full. You could keep on having a good time. And in Isaiah 55, first two verses, it says, "Ho, everyone who thirsts, come to the waters. And he who has no money, come buy and eat. Come buy wine and milk without money and without bread, and without money and without price. Why do you spend your money for that which is not bread, and your labor for that which does not satisfy? Hearken diligently to me and eat what is good, and delight yourselves in fatness." I think that about says it. Delight yourself. And that's what they've been doing in the snack bar all day, delighting themselves in fatness. When the children were wandering in the middle of the day, was that if they ran into anyone in the desert, of course they gave them something to eat. Any stranger would. If you and I met each other in the desert, we'd give each other something to eat. But if we were enemies, we wouldn't eat together. If I was the queen and you came to my court and you did something I thought was horrid and I wanted to reprimand you, I wouldn't cut off your head or cut off your hand. I would send you away from the table. You'd have to eat alone. And after a while, then we can understand why the meal has such powerful symbolism. Now, up here many times, I'm so tired when I get to the table, I just kind of sit there like a lump, especially if I'm with other staff people. And we just kind of nod at each other and giggle. But you can imagine, you've all been to those dinners, which are just wonderful dinners. You still remember them 10, 15 years later, Christmas dinner, or when somebody came home or somebody was going away. How full that time can be. Well, we use our contemporary experience and build on the biblical one. And the biblical one is very, very important. The Jewish tradition at meals with the prayers and the blessings that we see epitomized in the Passover meal. Have any of you been to a Passover meal, gone through the prayers or gone through the meal? Have you been to one? That can be an incredible insight into a different way to look at meals and to look at life. Once a year, they review the history of crossing the Red Sea and coming to the Promised Land. And in the context of that meal, there are four cups of wine that are passed. And the meals I've been at, it's the same cup. And the leader starts it, big chalice, and it goes all the way around. A kiddush cup, K-I-D-D-U-S-H, is a cup of blessing. So it's natural in an important meal that they would mark certain points this way. We used to do house blessings and line all the friends up in the house, all the way around the inside of the house as much as we could, and start a cup, and everyone would raise a blessing to the house. That kind of awareness of people coming together in a particularly intimate way, of eating together, is where the bread comes in. Now, many times there is a question as to using leavened or unleavened bread. Scholars still disagree on whether it was or was not a Passover meal that Jesus celebrated the night he died. Yeah, the night before he died. John, the Gospels do not agree. John particularly sticks out like a sore thumb. And there just is no consensus. So there are Passover-like qualities to the meal, but any Jewish meal has Passover-like qualities to it. The other key thing is that the Greek word for unleavened bread is not used. The word for bread is used, for leavened bread. The other part that I, besides those two kind of factual bits, is that I feel that we are people of the New Covenant. We are New Testament people. While we all have our little Egypts and our bondages to come out of, I feel that we are celebrating the risen Christ. And in celebrating the risen Christ, and in using a symbol that is common to our everyday experience, that's leavened bread. That, for me, that's not crackers, it's leavened bread. This brings us into a little bit of seeing life in a sacramental way. How often do you celebrate communion in your congregation?
Once a month.
Once a month. And your?
Well, once a month, and we're going to second service every week.
So it would be an option in your congregation mm-hmm. to have it every single week, mm-hmm. but you don't have to have it every single week.
One service would be once a month. The other service would be every week.
Every week. Well, that'd be like a folk service, or just mm-hmm. exact? Yeah. Okay. And you? Once a month, and up here it's every week. Yeah. Well, I'm glad. Frankly, that makes me very happy. Yeah, good. In the Lutheran Church, especially since the turn of the century, there has been a renewal of liturgy, a renewal of sacramental theology, using the sacrament more often. At the turn of the century, it was common to have communion either Good Friday or four times a year, quarterly. One would go to the pastor for confession, private confession, the week before, so that he would know exactly how many were going to commune. It was a very rigid process. The emphasis in church at that time was a very individual one, centered on the word, on preaching. Well, to be Lutherans, we believe in the word and the sacrament. At the turn of the century, it was the word and the sacrament. Now, we're beginning to bring the mountain down and the valley up. And that requires a fundamental shift in perception on our part. To listen to someone preach means we sit in our pews, like you're sitting listening to me, and really all you're very aware of is from the neck on up, and sometimes, whoops, I use my hands, drop my pens, so that you're aware of me in a basically a pretty static way. The offering comes up to the front and the pastor is there and you have your place and the pastor has his place. Now there's a lot of things changing all at once. We have male and female pastors and we have a big emphasis on liturgy. Processions and hymns and brighter colors, more of a sense experience. Things to touch and to see and to smell. And we're much more aware of our neighbor. That's what all this passing the peace is about. We can't sit in our pew alone anymore. We have to greet the person next to us. My mother used to just embarrass me to tears at mother-daughter banquets because we'd sit down and she'd say, "Now, does everybody know everybody?" And I'd just slide under the table. You know, I was 10 or 11 or 12. "Mother, if they want to know each other, they'll introduce themselves." And I couldn't understand why. Well, by the time I was in college, I figured out it must have been genetic because I was introducing everyone to everyone, and I even introduced two people who'd lived together for 4 years. We were sitting at the table, and no one was saying anything, and I said, "Well, I thought, they must not know each other. Tom, do you know Harry?" And everyone dropped their forks and looked at me and said, "Suze, they've been living together for 4 years now. They're roommates." So we are in here communally. We are not here to have an individual, mystical relationship to God, which was plausible when one only had communion four times a year. It was an out of the ordinary experience, very separate, very private. Now, to have an individual mystical experience with God every Sunday is not going to work. I know. I've tried. With the sacrament, God is seeking us out. God is coming to us. And that means that he's coming to us when we are ready for him and when we're not. He is seeking us out when we are tired and when we are suffering, as well as when we're so excited and when we are so happy and overflowing. He comes to us at every point in our life and says, "Hello, I'm here." God is seeking us out. Well, that's very different than an individual mystical experience, because God is not only seeking us out through the bread and the wine, he's seeking us out through the people around us. We are here to recognize Christ in one another. Well, that's a big shift. That's a very big shift. And when we institute changes, many times, we change what's on the surface. We change what is on the surface. Something might come in a different door, or we might get a different banner. But it's very rare that we ever talk about all those layers of symbolism that go way down deep. Many times, the meanings of the symbols have never been even said out loud. I remember when I was a little kid, I thought the pastor didn't wear anything under his clothes, you know? And it wasn't until I was much older, 17, 18, that I realized they must. But no one had ever said anything. So when I came back to preach after I'd gotten into seminary, I dressed in front of the congregation, because there were all my, you know, there's my fourth grade teacher, and there was my kindergarten teacher and my high school physics teacher. And I thought, how are we ever going to be at the same place at the same time? So I dressed in front of them. And when I said the line, you know, when I was a little kid, I thought they didn't wear anything under this, the whole congregation roared. So they must have all thought the same thing when they were little. The main point here then is that to use the sacrament more often means that we've got to be aware in a different way of what's going on in our lives, and that's that God is seeking us out. Not that we only hear of God through the Word, but it's Word and sacrament. It also means that we're much more aware of baptism. Baptism is the sacrament of admittance into the congregation. Now, we don't follow that through. In fact, there's a controversy going on right now in the LCA about baptism, about communion of infants. Gretchen Jensen from Philadelphia. And they say, yes, the babies should be communed. And other people are saying, no. So there's a lot going on right now. And we also have a new LBW. And the emphasis there, frankly, is on communion. I was happy to notice that a few congregations use the service of the Word on Word Sundays and the communion service on Communion Sunday, instead of kind of doing the little splice together number. And I think that book's going to make a big deal of difference, because there's so much in there. Last night here, you mean? Mm-hmm. In the Vesper service, we used a communion hymn.
Night before.
Yeah. I see, a different setting. Uh-huh. Yeah, well, there's...
For the communion, we use...
A short hymn. Okay, fine. I'd love to hear, because I'm very curious as to what congregations are doing with that book. I've had a little bit of a...
I wish we had more musically inclined people, you know, that could sing like we did last night.
Yeah, that makes a big difference. Uh-huh. You can get used to it a lot quicker. And there's some funny jumps in there. Mm-hmm. There's one in the service, the first setting for communion, where you've got to get the alleluias in there right away. If you take a breath, the organist is gone and you're going, lula, ya, la. But the other thing that is, now the Isaiah passage is from the Old Testament. From the New Testament, the passage that makes the biggest difference to me, and I, obviously we could... You don't talk about bread in 10 minutes and exhaust it. It's a central symbol. Is the road to Emmaus. When the disciples are walking along, and I'll just start reading from the 24th chapter, the 28th verse. So they drew near to the village to where they were going. He appeared to be going further, but they constrained him, saying, Stay with us, for it is toward evening, and the day is now far spent. In other words, stay and eat with us, a mark of hospitality. Remember, Jesus has died, and the disciples are so terribly upset. And they have walked with this stranger all day, and they don't know who it is. All day. So they drew near to the village and constrained him and said, you know, in good Hebrew hospitality, stay with us and eat, for the day is now far spent. So he went in to stay with them. When he was at table with them, he took the bread and blessed and broke and gave it to them. For action shape. That's what we say every single Sunday that we celebrate communion. Took the bread and blessed it and broke it and gave it to them. And their eyes were open and they recognized him, and he vanished out of their sight. Two verses, 30 and 31. When he was at table with them, he took, blessed, broke, and gave, and their eyes were open. That's a pretty graphic statement as to how important the Eucharist was, or the place of bread was to them in their meal and in their relationship to the Christ. They walked all day with him, but they didn't recognize him until they broke bread together, until they sat down at table and they weren't on the dusty road and their feet had been washed, until they were able to sit for a moment and watch him break the bread. Are there any... Now, what this makes me think of is not only how important bread is, but also how important doing the liturgy with care is. Do you have particular pastors that you can watch when they're at the altar? That they know that they're there and they want to be there and they do the liturgy with care. I would imagine you would if your congregation has communion that often. Many pastors, you see, have not been trained in worship and liturgy. It's funny enough, one of the things that gets left out, which makes, you know, I mean, we can always be upset about seminary curriculum, but to have someone who kind of fills the space and whose pastoral touch and sense the Eucharist is a perfect vehicle for. I don't know if you're in the habit of looking the person in the eye who gives you the bread or the wine, or touching their hand, or saying amen. But that is a very special moment when the pastor or the server comes to you with the bread or the wine. 90% of what we say is nonverbal. 90%. So you don't have to have a whole conversation, obviously, while you're there at the rail. But to make eye contact or to make hand contact is an incredible way of kind of marking the moment. In large congregations, sometimes that's hard. There's a lot of people. But I think that we've got to guard against that. We've got to keep an edge there so that that is a full, full moment. But it's like a chord that hasn't gotten the last, it's like a scale without the last two notes. And it's a common, some families that's a habitual practice. That's part of being a church, right? See, what's happening in the Lutheran church is that they were having, the old joke used to be there's more communion that goes on at the coffee hour after the service than there is during the service. Well, I think that table, the tide there is beginning to turn. Now, that doesn't mean that we have to, you know, have balloons and popcorn at church. What that means is that we can fill that sense a little fuller. That means we have to be a little closer to the folks around us. But I think that's a darn good exercise for the community of faith. It is now 20 to 5, and I said we'd go about 40 minutes. This subject, to me, I can wax at length on and love to. In fact, all of worship I love to talk about. I got to study with some very good people. And you two would like a copy? You would like, and would you? Four, okay? Excuse me. Oh, good for you!
If you could just write down those two Bible verses that you had,
Well, as a matter of fact, since this was taped, you could even take a tape home.
Okay.
See, the tape librarian has her stuff together. Sure, and I'll write down the bread. You see, bread is a. For example, the Gospel of Mark. I'll just add on one more chapter here. The Gospel of Mark was the very first gospel written, and Mark was trying to say a new thing to the Jewish people, and the way he did it was to use the paradigm of the Exodus. When did you arrive?
Saturday.
So you heard the sermon on Sunday. Mm-hmm. And remember how I talked about crossing the sea?
Mm-hmm.
Well, where else have people crossed a sea? The Red Sea. They crossed the sea the night of the Passover. From oppression into the promised land. The horse and the rider have been thrown into the sea. And it's striking in Mark how the symbolism of the bread is used. The bread that they had to take right now, right away with them. And the symbolism of the bread in Mark fed the 7,000, fed the 5,000, and finally fed one another at the Last Supper. There's links of the symbol bread between the New Testament and the Old Testament all the way along. Now, there was also something called show bread, which is used in the temple in the Old Testament, and that was taken into the Holy of Holies, and it was to commemorate the Passover. Well, remember when King David and his crew came through and they were hungry and they ate the bread that they weren't supposed to? That's the bread they ate. And then we have in the New Testament in Mark where Jesus talks about man is for the Sabbath. Sabbath is for the man. Well, however it goes. The man is here. I've just mixed up. We are here to fill up the Sabbath. We are not here to be restricted by rules. In other words, where does the bread fit in our lives? I cannot cite you chapter and verse on that, and I would like to. So what I'm saying is that in your church library or at a community library, there's a reference book called a concordance. And it will list, and I have a very small one here, it will list the word and word form, like bird and birds, and it will list every single time it's mentioned. And that can be a kind of a fun thing, for example, educationally, is to give little kids Bible verses and have them, you know, stack them up. It's also fun if you have Bread for the World people. Bread for the World group is out of New York. We had a group in a church in Oakland, and we had a bread sale on a Sunday to earn money to send back to the national office. It was a weird Sunday. It was like two Sundays after Easter. No one was in church. No one at all. And we were sold out of bread in 15 minutes, just like that. So bread is one of those things to have a lot of fun with, mm-hmm. and especially then after being up here where we have fresh bread. Which reminds me, the Holden Cookbook should be here in the next two or three or four days. And there's quite a section in there on bread. If you're leaving in the next one or two or three days, you can sign up at the bookstore and pay your money and we'll ship it to you. But they have a lot of the philosophy things that I was saying to the staff of life. And there's beautiful symbolism there. As we are members of the body, as the bread is broken, and we each receive a piece, as Christ was broken for our sins, so are we broken for one another. It lends a lot of open doors to some very beautiful and deep symbolism. The historical answer to that is something that's called ablutions. And that is that the chalice, that wine and that bread which were consecrated are consumed directly after the meal, directly after the service in the sacristy. In an Episcopalian service or a Roman Catholic service, they will consume them before they proceed with the rest of the service. That's why Episcopalians rarely use bread, because, you know, there would the priest be just jamming down all this bread. I've been at one of those. Just once, though. That's all that happens to any priest. And there is, the chalice is drunk, and then a little bit of water is poured in and it's swirled and it's drunk again, so that it is all consumed. That can be impractical. What we do, it's the second option, what we do at the seminary is we have Eucharist every Wednesday. Are you familiar with the term Eucharist? Mm-hmm. It means Thanksgiving, okay. Is that one of the servers, one of the assisting ministers, will actually wander among the crowd with the plate, and people will take off a little bit so that it's all consumed. If it's particularly good bread, it goes very quickly, and if it's, you know, I mean, it's a wonderful way for the minister to meet people too. The third option is that it's consumed in the sacristy. I can understand people taking offense at the bread for the Eucharist going home for peanut butter sandwiches. Not that it necessarily would have to be peanut butter sandwiches, but if you know, it sounds as though there's a little bit of tension here. So that's probably the idea. I can understand scattering it on the grounds, except I would not want to scatter too much because I live here with chipmunks and mice, and I sure don't want to draw. No, this would be among the ministers or the sacristans in the sacristy afterwards. You see, and this can be done after the service is all done and people are milling around over or are talking. The other thing I would say is that when you bake the bread, I mean, you have a pretty good, you can eye pretty well how much you're going to use. Make one large loaf and make two or three smaller ones. And use the main one up and then start on the second one. Theologically or symbolically, that might not be as full as we'd like, but that sure is a little bit more convenient. And I'm all for, I resent having to jump through rules, through hoops of rules. And I think that if there's a beautiful loaf for the pastor to hold up or for people to see, fine. We did Eucharist at PLU for conventions and for baccalaureate where we would have 17 or 20 loaves of bread on a big table as you entered in the gymnasium. Just incredible to see all that bread and to see it all used. Just wonderful. So there's no law that says only one. If you have two services, you use the bread, the loaf for the first service, and you have a little bit left over. You take a small linen napkin called a purificator or something small, and you just wrap it in, like almost like a butcher wrap, and just set it right there on the plate with it, and everyone knows that it's from first service. That's no secret. And then you use it right along with the loaf the second service. Or you can retain a little bit and the pastor can take it on his or her sick calls. What are you most comfortable with? Perhaps something that would be helpful here is the way that Martin Luther viewed the sacrament, for example, is that Christ is present in, with, and under the earthly elements. Martin Luther never used one word when he could use five. In, with, and under. That means that we don't have to use red wine for the Eucharist. We can use rosé, we can use white, because it's not an actual representation of Christ's blood. Well, like I said, very few people ever talk out loud about what communion means to me. And in fact, that's kind of like talking about your boyfriend or your girlfriend. That's very intimate stuff that you just don't hang out on the line, frankly. So to talk about it out loud needs a lot of care. And it sounds as though this is the issue the people who are unhappy with having communion every week have latched on to.
No, I wouldn't buy that.
Okay.
It's a valid issue.
Okay. Then I would use that quote from Martin Luther. We do not believe in transubstantiation. We do not believe that actually becomes the body and the blood. And at the same time, we revere that. You know, we don't use the bread in a callous way. It's obvious that communion means a lot to the people who are bringing it up. Well, I think my suggestion number one would be use a loaf and use a little loaf so that you have less left over. Oh, do they take off their own?
Yes, that's
the way. Ah.
Rather than
we used to say at college, you know, take about a size of a quarter. You might have to gown up and serve. That's the thing with bread. I have never run out. I have run darn close, but I have never run out. This recipe will feed between 100 and 250 people, depending on who's serving the bread, just like you said. Then when I commune in that situation, I become so preoccupied with getting the bread down discreetly that my attention is really flagged from why I'm there. Well, you see, you can imagine, congregations want to try that out, and they don't really have any resources, and the pastor gets up the first Sunday and goes, and it's kind of embarrassing. But how many people do you usually have at a communion? You don't need a very big loaf for that, then. Then maybe you could just... maybe you could just play around with that a little bit. Ask the bread baker to make however many loaves he or she makes, to make, just say, we're going to try around about this now.
You wouldn't see anything wrong with it.
I think that's lovely. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to skip over that. Yeah. I think that is just lovely. I think
it's
that would work. I think it makes sense. I really do.
It's probably the option.
The reason we pour the wine out on the ground is to revere it. It has been a heavenly vehicle. Well, makes sense. And if you've heard any of John Schramm's lectures, it also makes sense to feed the birds and those around us. Yeah.